Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, your life connection to the information for a healthy body, an enlightened mind, and a renewed spirit.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Integrity in Action, live on Body, Mind, Spirit Radio, monthly from 7 to 8 p.m. This is your opportunity to listen live with host Lois Shulman, empowerment coach, facilitator, and public speaker of Integrity in Action, LLC. She will interview with sensitivity, unconditional love, and without judgment individuals who have chosen to exemplify the highest levels of ethical principles, sound moral character, and honesty. Each month, a featured guest will share their story. These interviews will give listeners an opportunity to feel the passion and emotion of the person being interviewed, as well as inspire listeners to entertain a new perspective from which to expand their own understanding. When this occurs, we move beyond the limitations of our current thinking to heal and become more aware, awake, and expansive. And now I give you your wonderful host, Lois Shulman.
Good evening, everybody. Recently, I was called upon to introduce Katie Donovan at a state conference. To prepare, I watched a network news video in which Katie was being interviewed. She was being interviewed to shed light on the increasingly high number of drug overdose deaths in the state of Michigan. Watching and listening to the interview, I saw and felt Katie's emotions as she courageously spoke about the seven-year drug addiction journey she and her daughter found themselves walking and at times running through. Katie's choice to speak and to share her story filled me with feelings of admiration for her choices, gratefulness for her bravery, and inspiration to the best that I could be in my community. Katie has made a commitment to walk with those going through their own journeys. She wants and says that she wants no one to have to walk alone. When Katie's presentation was complete, there was a standing ovation and tears for what I believe is the gift that Katie brings to her commitment. And that is the gift of her integrity, embraced by her audience into their own personal feelings. Katie today is fulfilling that commitment along many avenues, including as the CEO, Chief Executive Officer of A Mother's Addiction Journey, and EVP, which is the Executive Vice President of the nonprofit Families Against Narcotics. She serves with Hope Not Handcuffs, and as a national speaker on addiction, author, and blogger. The blog, co-founded with her daughter, Brittany, is viewed by people from countries all over the world. Katie, I would like our listeners to know you and your many complex roles with family, friends, and those who reach out to you for help. I'd like you to begin your story however is comfortable for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Such an honor. This is an excellent platform to spread the message of hope and empowerment and healing. And, growing up, I was brought up in a very kind of strict Irish Catholic home. And I was very uncomfortable ever going outside of the rules or outside of a structure. I was very by the book, great grades, almost straight A's usually, homecoming court, very involved in sports, and just try to stay on the right path. And I had a lot of friends and very open and bubbly. And I was also, because we were very Irish Catholic, taught to you're saving yourself as a woman until you become married. And I don't know if it's one of those moments you go through growing up as a teenager or becoming a young adult and a young woman. But at the age of 19, I ended up becoming involved with this young man, and we did engage in premarital sex, something that I had always been against, and it only took one time, and I became pregnant, and I was now faced with, once I was going to go away to college and have these incredible future, at least in my mind. Now I had a different life that was going to be coming for me, right? And how do I handle this? And very, very shortly after I became pregnant, that young man wanted nothing to do with the pregnancy. Although we did try things for a little bit, we were young, 19 years old. And
can I just, what was the reaction of your family?
My family, they were very embarrassed. They were very, we can't tell anyone. There were no baby showers or anything like that. Actually, a few weeks before I actually gave birth, my girlfriend threw me one. It was just more of, this wasn't how you were raised. Yeah. Although they were very supportive, it was in a quiet way. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
We'll handle this very, very privately as a family. And that young man, he ended up becoming extremely abusive. And to the point where I remember it was a week before I gave birth, and he was chasing me around the apartment with a screwdriver because he wanted to kill the baby. He didn't want to have this baby. And that was a moment. I think I've had we all have those moments in life. I've had several, and that was definitely a big, big moment in my life where I thought, I have a choice now. I can either stay with this abusive relationship and raise my child in this environment, or I can leave. But I was petrified. I was only 19 years old. I was a baby myself. But I did. I left because I knew that isn't how my life is supposed to be. I have to get out of this environment. And so that really began my original journey with my daughter, Brittany. And it was just the two of us for many, many years. And there were times where I didn't end up going away to college and doing those things, although I did go to college locally. But it was a struggle, right, as a single mom. And I did have support of my family. There's no doubt they were there for me spiritually. If I needed to go to class, they definitely helped with babysitting. But for the most part, I felt this is my family, this is my life, and I don't want to depend on anyone else to do this. This happened to me, and it's my job to take care of it. And so I didn't care if we were down to, and it happened, you know, two pieces of bologna and four pieces of bread. I'm not going to go to mom and dad and say, I need help with groceries. I need to learn how to budget, and I need to learn how to coupon and stretch that dollar and do whatever I can because it's my life. And you sacrifice those things for your children. And that was kind of, I guess, where my strength began, was very, 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 very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I fought my way up through the corporate ladder, and I was very blessed to be able to get positions where slowly but surely I didn't have to worry so much about things financially. But I was very, very involved in my daughter's life. We were extremely close. And when I met my husband, my daughter was actually 5 years old when we met. But we dated for 5 years. And I wanted to be sure that I didn't really date much during that time of my, I guess you could call them single years. Because one, my priority is my daughter, and two, I didn't want to have her see me dating any men. And if I did get a babysitter, I want to make sure I'm going to have a guaranteed good time. So I would have dinner with girlfriends and not waste my time, you know, if that makes sense. But when I did meet John, we dated for 5 years, and I wanted just to be really sure that this was someone that would be positive in my life and an asset, because I was very content with my life. Meeting him was just an added bonus. I wasn't searching for anything at that time. And so we got married, and shortly thereafter we had a baby together. So our children ended up to be 12 years apart by the time the marriage and the baby occurred. And that, you know, for my oldest, Brittany, at that point, I think it was a hard transition for her. Even though we had dated for some time, now all of a sudden we're married. Although when he proposed, he did it in such a special way. He did get down on one knee and do the traditional, will you marry me, to myself. But then after I had said yes, he got down on one knee and asked my daughter if he could be her dad. And he gave her a ring as well. So it was this very, you know, beautiful, beautiful moment of he understands because you're not just marrying me. This is instant family, and that's what's important to me. And but Brittany had a hard time with the transition because we did move, and then all of a sudden there's a new baby, and we're all living in this house together, and it was difficult, I think, for her. And she did struggle a little bit emotionally. But then our lives kind of leveled out and everything became smooth. And we were very, very involved as parents. My husband coached my oldest Brittany's basketball teams and baseball teams. And I was that PTA mom and Brownie leader. And we both had very blessed with corporate careers. And we taught our children about alcohol and taught them about drugs. But honestly, I think it was more of in a general sense of just don't do drugs, don't hang around that type of crowd and that type of thing. And we never really had experience with addiction in our families either. I was never exposed to addiction. I wasn't familiar with it. And so when things started creeping up slowly with my oldest daughter, Brittany, I was very clueless to the signs. A lot of it I chalked up to her being a teenager, a female with the hormones. And, you know, sometimes you had that attitude I didn't truly tune in on, I think, looking back, more of, I should have more. My daughter started dating a boy. And again, my oldest Brittany, she was very similar to me growing up. We were like two peas in a pod. She was always on the honor roll and very, very involved in sports and athletic and popular and happy and just always on the go. And so, and we had family nights and very, very engaged with our kids. And so Brittany in her senior year, she started dating this boy, and he was a hockey player and he seemed like a good kid and good family, you know, no real issues. And, I didn't realize, though, at that time that several kids on the hockey team had been prescribed opiates for a sports injury. And so that became their party drug, I guess you could call it, on the weekends. They didn't really drink. They didn't really smoke marijuana or things like that. They took this prescription and thought it was okay because it was prescribed by a doctor. This started in 2008. I think it's really ramped up with the epidemic, and there's a lot more education out now. And
can I ask you one question?
Yes.
So did you think that she was doing this because she felt there was no danger in using this because it was a prescription drug and it was something that in her mind wasn't bad for you?
Absolutely.
And it gave a good feeling, so why not do it and have a little fun?
Yes, it made her feel good, and there's no harm in it because it's a legitimate prescription. I'm not buying it off the streets. I'm not going down to the inner city to get this. This is okay, and we're not harming anyone. These kids have prescriptions, and they were given them legitimately. So, that's what they did. And unfortunately, my daughter's brain reacted in such a way that it loved her and she loved it. And so what began with 1 to 2 pills on a weekend turned into 3 and 4, 5 and 6, and then it started happening during the week. But I didn't realize it at the time.
So looking back, were there any things that You said at one point you should have noticed something.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you think that if you had known more, you might have noticed?
The weight loss. There was a lot of weight loss, and pretty quickly. Lack of hygiene, where once she wouldn't even go to the local CVS without getting completely fouled up. Now she could go 4 to 5 days without even taking a shower.
Okay.
She was extremely, being, you know, extremely very, very conscious of what she looked like to really waking up and walking out without even brushing her teeth and putting a comb in her hair.
So what would you have done differently at that moment if you would have, having had this experience, which you're going to tell us more about, but at that moment in time, what could you, in your mind, think you could have done?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. I did get her into counseling because I thought something mentally was going on. I thought she was becoming very depressed. I was concerned because when she was once happy-go-lucky, now she was becoming very isolated and withdrawn. And I took the lack of hygiene due to depression. That's what I was familiar with. We have depression in my family, bipolar, and I thought, oh my gosh, these must be signs of it. That's what I had tuned into, having no clue that it was drugs because we did drug test her.
Oh, okay.
But at the time, I was buying the kits that showed cocaine and marijuana, that type of thing.
Oh.
And I just really had no idea that this truly was the issue.
And she never shared with you that she was had ever taken anything?
No, not at all.
Do you think she knew what was going on? Do you think she put it together, like, I'm taking these pills? And
I think in the back of her mind she knew this is wrong. I think because also just really 6 months prior to this beginning, we had a code word in our family where if you're in a situation that you're not comfortable with, you can call or text me with that code word. Ours happened to be Bible. And she had texted me one night the code word, Bible. And I immediately called, is everything okay? You don't have to tell me. That was the agreement, right? You know, you're not busted for anything. Where are you? Are you safe? And she reassured me, Mom, I'm fine. I'm safe. But my ride has been drinking, and I don't feel comfortable. Can you pick me up? So I think going from that in her morals, knowing to now I'm taking these pills and it's making me feel really good, I think in the back of her mind, she knew this isn't something I'm supposed to be doing, but it made her feel so good. And now her brain is responding to you need more, you need more, you need more. It was probably more of a fleeting moment where this will just stop. This is just a phase. I can stop anytime. I don't need this kind of thing to function. But that is kind of how the disease of addiction begins. It is a very slow but progressive disease. And it, in her mind, this wasn't a problem. And so we did get her into therapy, et cetera, but it didn't work, but I thought that's what I was supposed to be doing at that time.
But she must have been so tortured and conflicted because being a child who wants to please her mother and
mm-hmm.
so close to her mother,
mm-hmm.
Gosh, she must have been torn apart by the
wanting
to be part of this, wanting this feeling.
And then also when she stopped being involved in the family and would. Her and her little sister were very, very close, very, very close. And her little sister was like a mini-me, would follow her big sister Brittany everywhere. And they did a lot of things together. And then slowly those things stopped. And my little youngest didn't understand, but she promised me we would go shopping, or she promised me we would play Legos today. She called her Mimi because she couldn't say Brittany when growing up, so Mimi just kind of stuck. And where's Mimi? She told me she would come home and color with me. And then I started making excuses as to why Mimi wasn't there. And that I didn't want to hurt her, but I obviously couldn't tell her the truth because I didn't even really know what was going on. I just knew something was going on. And that's, I also feel how secrets begin with addiction. We start to make up excuses before we even realize that anything is really going on. And then it took about, eventually my daughter Brittany moved out because we did kind of try and control the situation because she had crashed a car. She was under the influence of prescription medication at the time, and we took the car away, we took the phone away, got her into deeper therapy, and we actually got her into treatment at one point, and it would only lasted about 5 days because insurance said it wouldn't cover anymore because she didn't have former evidence of being substance abuse. And fast forward.
Can I just, when did you realize what she was actually doing? Did the therapists, were they able to answer?
No, because she wasn't truthful with the therapist as well.
Okay.
She didn't want to be truthful with anybody, I think, at that point. Mm-hmm. But it was when she had moved out she'd moved out and gotten an apartment with this young man, the hockey player. And she had come home from work one day, and she felt really, really sick. And he said, at this point, they had just been taking the pill in whole form. And he said, well, snort this. It'll make you feel much better. And she said, no. I think I have flu. I just want to go to bed and lay down, maybe have some Gatorade. And he said, no, I promise you, you're going to feel much better. So she did. She snorted it. And she did feel better. She didn't realize at the time, actually, what was happening was she was having withdrawals. And that snorting lasted for a few months. And he finally admitted to her that actually what she had been snorting was heroin. And she thought, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I can't believe this. How could you lie to me? How could you? But by that time, now she was so addicted, she couldn't stop. And that was her first one when she came to me and said, I have a problem, Mom. And she had been snorting at that time, and we got her into treatment. And that's when the treatment lasted 5 days.
How and where did Brittany choose to come to you with the shock of knowing now that she had not been snorting prescription drugs, but she was actually snorting heroin?
Well, she called me one day and said, Mom, I really need to tell you something really important. And so we met for dinner at Applebee's, and she was pretty calm, and I was very nervous. Honestly, what I thought she was going to say was that she was pregnant. And when she said thought she was addicted to heroin, it was this odd feeling that came over me, to be honest with you. It wasn't like I was shocked. I was internally, but I was afraid of showing that emotion, that I didn't want to scare her off, that she was trusting me with this. And I instantly went into fix-it mode of calm, cool, collected. Okay, we're going to get you help. We're going to fix this. We're going to take care of things. And that's what I thought I was going to do. When we got her into treatment right away, she was very willing to go. And unfortunately, her treatment didn't last very long at that point. But through treatment, she was suggested to go to a sober living home. And she had been there for a few weeks and got her first job. She got a paycheck. We thought we're on our way to new beginnings. And I had invited her over for dinner to kind of celebrate her new journey in life, and I made her favorite meal of beef stroganoff, and her little sister made her a welcome home card, you know, with flowers on it, and I love you, and we kept looking at the time, and she was very late, very, very late. When she finally called, and she was screaming and crying. And it come to find out, as she was driving to our home, she said it was like her car ended up having almost like a mind of its own. She was driving on the expressway and came upon the exit where she would normally go to buy her drugs. And her car just left the expressway, pulled up in front of her dealer's home, and she bought drugs. Walk car, when she heard footsteps coming up behind her, and someone yelled out, "Hey, Snow Bunny," and they pulled her by her hair and dragged her into a field, and they beat her, and then they ended up raping her. And any, I think, rational person would normally call 911, call your mom, something like that. She ended up walking back to that house, her dealer's house, and her first thought was, "I gotta get high." Instead of calling for help, she was just numb and wanted to make the pain go away, and the pain was going to go away for her by using. And she ended up staying in this drug house. They call it a trap house. It was really a abandoned home where many people struggling with addiction lived, I guess you could call it. They moved, cleaned out a room for her, put a dirty mattress on the floor, had no running water, and she stayed there for about 6 months. And her dealer used her car, and he gave her free drugs for use of it.
So, and Katie, how did you get through that time? That 6 months, I mean, that's a huge amount of time. How did you handle it?
I didn't, to be honest with you. It was very difficult. That was in the beginning of her, really the beginning of her journey. And it was very overwhelming to know that your daughter, who was on the honor roll, was so gifted, so beautiful, bundle of personality. And we lived in an upper middle class neighborhood with a safe, warm home. And to know that she's living in a place like that, that's so indescribable. I honestly, I couldn't breathe. It was like, you know, that when you get a call that a loved one has been in a car accident, and you're racing to the emergency room, and your heart is pounding, and you don't know whether they're dead or alive. That's the feeling that I had every minute of every day. It was. I couldn't breathe. I didn't sleep. I barely ate. I didn't cook well. I'm not going to lie. I did not cook well at that time.
So, Katie, did you have people that you reached out to at this point? Did you share yet with everybody what was going on? Or
not at all. The only person that knew was my husband. We didn't tell anyone in the family or my friends. And I don't know if it wasn't really shame, I think, on my part. It was more of, I wanted to protect her. And I thought, well, we'll get through this. Nobody ever has to know. What if she gets better? I didn't want that judgment and stigma to always be with her. And I also, I knew that people may inadvertently judge me as well, or not want to be around us. The whispers that go on behind your back, maybe not intentionally, maybe not even in a negative way, but naturally people just say, "Oh gosh, did you hear that? Brittany's struggling with addiction, or Katie's daughter's addicted to heroin." And it's good gossip, right? And I didn't want to be the subject of it. So I stayed quiet. It was very, very hard. It took me many, many years to get through that and come out and really talk to others about that.
So how did that stay actually end at the drug house? How did that come to a stop?
At that particular point, I finally got to a point of you know, my husband didn't want me to go down there. It was dangerous, obviously, and he didn't want me to be in a situation that was unhealthy. And I did finally just do it myself. I didn't tell him. And I jumped in my car one day. I couldn't take it anymore. And I drove down to that house, and I literally busted in through the door like I was the FBI. And they, honestly, I think were more scared of crazy mom than if I was the FBI. And I literally pulled her out of there and got her into treatment. I got her on a flight to California. And it was funny. She didn't really go kicking and screaming. It was almost a relief for her. It's so hard for her to reach out and admit, what am I doing?
Yeah.
I need help. But for someone to come in and say, this is it. You're done with this. It almost was a relief. Please get me out of here. And so she went to California. She did pretty well there for a little while. And we actually flew out there as a family around Thanksgiving to celebrate and visit her. Unfortunately, shortly thereafter, she did relapse right before Christmas. And I had sent her presents in the mail right before her relapse. And I remember that she was on the streets of California. And I didn't know how to handle that. My daughter is thousands of miles away. And I didn't know where she was in the streets. And she's literally sleeping in an alley, sleeping in a laundromat. And I ended up getting her a hotel room on Christmas Eve. Right or wrong, that's what I did at that time. I think it was more looking back for myself than for her, if that makes sense. That sounds horrible. I realized how enabling that was, but I couldn't live with the fact that my daughter would be sleeping on the streets on Christmas. And so we ended up opening up presents via FaceTime. And I remember this horrible feeling watching her open her presents, and she was so high. And she was trying to pretend that she was really enjoying this, opening up presents. And my little youngest daughter, Brooke, kept looking at me funny, like, what's wrong with Mimi? What's wrong with Mimi? And I said, oh, she's just really tired, honey. She's just really tired. And I tried to pretend like everything was okay, but internally I was just so broken to see this. Your daughter's so sick and you don't know how to help her. From there, she ended up going to Seattle for several years, kind of in and out of treatment again there too. It was a long, long road. She did get to a point of getting clean there for about 6 months, and she had gone back to school for nursing and asked if she could come home to finish her nursing degree. And at this point, she had been away for about 3 years, and we thought she had been cleaned. So we did. We welcomed her back home, but we'll support her in her recovery and let her go back to school and get her life together. A few days after she had arrived home, we had a family friend that had passed away and had to go to the funeral. And while we were at the funeral home, Brittany had said to me, Mom, I'll be right back. I need to use the restroom. And she was in the restroom for quite some time, and that sinking feeling came over me again, and I just had a gut feeling that something is going on, something's bad is happening. Time went on, it got the better of me, and I went to the bathroom to go check on her. And when I came upon her, all I saw were her arms dangling from underneath the stall, and it ended up she was overdosed in the funeral home bathroom. And it was this, you know, that was our moment of trying to keep everything quiet. Well, we ended up having to call 911, and now everybody knew what was going on with my daughter. And it was very humbling. Here is, we're at a funeral, and my own daughter is practically killing herself in the bathroom. Shortly thereafter, we battened down the hatches, said, you know, no phone, no car, you're staying here, you can go to school, but we will drive you. We tried to really control the situation. Looking back, that did not work, but at the time we thought that was the best move. And it worked for about 2 weeks, and we were in the den one night watching the Grammys as a family, and all of a sudden my daughter stiffened up almost like a statue and tipped over, and that she ended up having a full-blown grand mal seizure, and it was the most horrific thing I'd ever seen in my life. And we ended up calling 911, and when she got to the hospital, she had two more grand mal seizures there. And I didn't know it at the time because of HIPAA. The doctors couldn't tell me, but she was actually, the seizures were caused from Xanax withdrawals. So when I thought we were doing the good thing by keeping her away from everything, trying to control the situation, she should have actually been in a medical detox because that could have been prevented. It was very, very scary. And from then on, it was just this cycle that continued and continued. And I think at one point, she just became so broken for years and years and years of this, that she just wanted to end it. She wanted to end her life. She couldn't take it anymore. Disappointing others, robbing, stealing, begging for money, waking up sick every day. Her whole job every day was going to find drugs. And it wasn't even about getting high anymore. It was just to function. It was to not feel sick. And she had called me one day and said, "Mom, I'm so sorry. I can't do this anymore. Please tell Dad and Brooke I love them." And she hung up. And I knew what she was doing. I knew what she was trying to end her life. And I didn't know where she was. And I was trying to find her. And I was so panic-stricken, looking everywhere for her. And I finally got word that she was in a Chase Bank bathroom. And so I ended up calling 911. And I knew the risks involved, that she could potentially have drugs on her and face jail time, but I would rather at that point have her in jail than dead. And they did find her, and they took her to the hospital, but I actually didn't get the call that she was in the emergency room until 7 hours later. And when I got there, what I found was she was on a gurney in a hallway, absolutely zero medical attention being given to her whatsoever. There's such a stigma surrounding addiction that I just don't think anybody really cared at that point. It was like, we'll get to it when we get to it. This is my daughter, right? This isn't some quote-unquote junkie. She's my baby. And yes, in her active addiction, she was absolutely doing horrible things, but it was because of her disease, not her inside. And I needed to save my child. You know, they're sick. You just do whatever you can to save them. And I literally had to scream out that she was overdosing for her to finally get some medical attention. And for me, that was kind of my moment of, I need to stop talking about what needs to change in this industry and be a change maker. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew that I needed to do something. Her addiction, unfortunately, kept going. We got her into treatment in Florida, and she was in and out of facilities there also. And it didn't just stop with that particular overdose. But she did end up getting a felony charge against her. She had one Xanax that was found on her. And by the time she did get, fortunately, a year clean, she came back to face those charges. And the judge ended up letting her off of everything. They saw that she had been really focused on her recovery, really trying so hard. She saw that the family wasn't enabling like we were. And for me, from my point, I had become so overwhelmed. It was very clear that whatever I had been trying to do to help her and fix her wasn't working. And I had never reached out for help. And I finally got to a point for myself. I knew I needed help. And it was a very strong moment that I have in my memory of my husband calling me one day and asking me to do something. I don't remember. It could have been, you know, taking the garbage out or something. I don't really remember, but I just remember exploding because I felt so pulled in so many different directions, trying to save my daughter, taking out fires every single day, and working full-time, having a very strong corporate career, along with, you know, being the center of the home. You're grocery shopping, you're making dinner, you're doing the everyday tasks in life. And I had a younger daughter that needed me as well. And I just felt such a pull and so much pressure and stress. And I just exploded at my husband saying, I can't take this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And I didn't mean with him or the garbage. It was more of life. I couldn't take this pain anymore that I was feeling inside. And I jumped in my car and I just drove and I drove and drove and drove. And I really had no destination in mind. I just wanted to get away. And it was pouring down rain. And I remember coming to a red light and just looking down. And I still had my pajama pants and slippers on. And it was about 2 in the afternoon. And that was my moment of, my God, what am I doing? What am I doing? I am collapsing as a person. I'm losing myself. Well, I lost myself. I wasn't focused on myself anymore. I would have become addicted to my daughter. And I had to start really working on myself because if I didn't stay strong, I was going to lose the rest of my family and probably myself too. And that is finally when I reached out for help to others and discovered a support group called Families Against Narcotics. And what I fell in love with this group is that it was not just a segmented group of moms, say, only who have family members struggling. This group encompassed everyone that was affected by addiction, people in there that have loved ones struggling. But there's also people that go to the support groups who are in recovery, those who have lost loved ones, drug court comes, community leaders in the community who want to know and be educated more about addiction. And that's where I learned I'm not alone. I learned about the disease of addiction. I became educated. And I also learned that what I thought I was doing as a mom that came so natural, when as you raise your children, we help them, we protect them, we get them well when they're sick. With the disease of addiction, it's the complete opposite almost of what you have to do. And I realized, my God, I was the number one enabler of all time, and I had no idea that I was. And once I started becoming stronger with myself, learning boundaries that were healthy, really educating myself on the disease, ironically, that's when my daughter started becoming stronger, because I started saying no to the disease because I realized I was working harder on her recovery than she was, and I needed to work on my own recovery. And it was very difficult, and it wasn't an easy thing to do overnight, and it is something that I have to work on a daily basis. But I ended up leaving my career and dove headfirst into this crazy world of addiction because over the 7 years, almost 8 years that my daughter had struggled, and being in 17 different treatment facilities, I learned so much. I learned what to do, what not to do, and navigating the insurance process, sober living homes, what's good, what's bad. I thought a treatment center was a one-size-fits-all. I was just so blind to this world, and I want to be able to help others not have the pain that I had, not go through everything that I had witnessed and things that come up in my nightmares that I know will never go away. I want to prevent other families from going through that. And that's when I got went back to school and became a nationally certified families addictions recovery coach, because I really feel that's where my heart is, because the families become just as sick, if not sicker, than the ones struggling. We see what goes on, and we still feel so helpless and hopeless. And it truly affected my marriage. It's affected my youngest daughter. And I'm so blessed now that I was able to come out of my darkness, but I see so many families in their darkness and the depths of it. And I really want, that's my goal and my mission, to help them get out of it and then in turn help get their loved ones get the treatment that they need and deserve.
Okay, so Katie, what about the first responders? What about police and authorities that come upon people that have addiction? How do you teach them about this stigma and give them the tools they need to help people when they find these situations?
Yeah, so I've made that my mission as well. I do go out and I train law enforcement on addiction. Families Against Narcotics, we just spearheaded a new program called Hope Not Handcuffs, where someone can walk into a police station in Macomb County if they're struggling with addiction and say, I need help. And an angel will be dispatched, and we will find them a bed into treatment right away. And we want them to know that they can come to a place where they're without judgment, where they're loved and accepted. And law enforcement is seeing this as a win-win because they are tired of arresting people left and right for the same petty crimes over and over. They're realizing arresting isn't working. We can't arrest our way out of this. They're sick. They have a disease that needs to be medically treated. And we have already seen such positive results since we started this program February 1st. We've helped 206 people into treatment, and law enforcement is ecstatic. They've already seen some of their crime rates go down. The judicial system isn't as overloaded. The emergency rooms aren't as overloaded with overdoses. And law enforcement is now seeing, wow, this is really making a difference, because this isn't the typical, stereotypical person that, you know, we saw in our visions years and years and years ago. This is such an epidemic. Everyone in some way, shape, or form is affected by addiction, no matter where you are from, your economic, socio, wherever you're at, it doesn't matter. My daughter, it's your brother, it's someone's grandmother, it could be the corporate executive, it's your next door neighbor, the high school quarterback. These are people, these are our community. This isn't someone else's problem. This is our problem, and we need to take care of our people. And I've seen such a change in law enforcement since then. I'm now getting calls from law enforcement when they're pulling someone over. Hey, Katie, I've got Susie. Normally I would arrest her, but she seems like she comes from a good family and a good girl, and can you help her? And I see them reaching out now in a different way. It's different for them. It's not what they are used to or how they've really been trained. So it's a hard change for them, but they are seeing that it's working as well. It's become this beautiful thing, and Hope Not Handcuffs is beginning. It's like this movement that's spreading across the state of Michigan. We have 10 more cities that are launching June 1st, and we have many more in the works. It's just very, very, very exciting.
So how does Brittany, now that you've taken so much of your life and dedicated so that others do not have to walk alone through what you did, how has Brittany become involved, and is she supportive of you doing this and telling her story as well as your own?
Absolutely, she is. About a year ago, I wanted to start writing about our journey, and I wanted to start blogging. And I'd never really blogged before, but before I did it, I sat the whole family down, and I explained my vision. I just wanted to almost journal online and help others. And we wanted to make sure the whole family was on board with it, because if one person was uncomfortable, that's a no-go, right? We're all in this together. And everyone was supportive, definitely including Brittany. And once I started writing and sharing, Brittany then felt compelled, Mom, I think I want to start sharing too. And so I would write a little journal entry on a memory, and then she would write a journal entry on a memory of hers, and it just became this beautiful, beautiful thing. And my God, it started being shared on Facebook left and right, and really within about 3 weeks of us blogging and starting this website, we had over 1 million visitors on the website in 146 countries. It was just incredible, so powerful. And it was these people all over the world saying, your story is my story, and my feelings are your feelings. I've never read anyone that's touched me the way you have, because I think the only one who can really write about it is someone that has gone through it, and they understand, and I understand, and they're not judged, especially by me. I just want people to know that I'm with you all the way, and if you need someone to talk to, if your loved one is struggling and they need to find treatment, call me. I will help you every step of the way. And Brittany has been amazing, because if I'm working with a family whose son, say, is really hesitant about going to treatment, I can pull Brittany in, and she will talk with that person who's struggling and say, I get it, buddy. I've been there. I understand. And then she changes their mind and gets them right in. It's where this crazy mother-daughter team now, which is unbelievable.
So I have to ask you, I've met you, I've listened to you, I am so taken with your, and I said it in the beginning, but your courage and your ability to help others. How do you make sure that you're okay, that you keep yourself in a good spot so you have what to give to others?
Right. That's a good question. Once I started becoming stronger and focusing on myself and starting to do the things that I loved once again, and for me personally, it was riding my bike. It was going to the gym. I needed to do that and shut my phone off for an hour or so to dig deep and just block everything out. And it's amazing when you're doing healthy things, what it can do for your body and for your soul and for your mind. It's just unbelievable. And ironically, about 6 months ago, I stopped doing that, not intentionally. I was getting an abundance of emails and phone calls from families needing help, and I felt so compelled. I had to answer every single one and in a timely manner, because, my God, they're reaching out for help. And I would get phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was just nonstop. And I realized I was relapsing. I stopped taking care of myself again. And how I'd become addicted to saving my daughter, I had now become addicted to saving other people. And although I still have to do that, that's my mission, that's my life, I know now that I have to make time for myself, because if I don't, I will crumble and I won't have that strength and time to truly take care of other people that need it. So that's what I do now. I have to make that time for a massage or for meditating or for yoga. There is no doubt I have to carve that out, because if I don't, I will relapse, and families can relapse as well, just like those struggling with addiction can. It's important to keep that, your recovery, in the forefront at all times.
Do you still go to support groups? Do you still participate in these groups? I know you're in leadership. Are you able to also participate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I usually go about once a week to a support group meeting. I have to keep that with me at all times, because I know that there is no cure for addiction. I know that my daughter could struggle again at any time. It could be today. It could be tomorrow. I have no idea. And I need to keep strong. And part of my healing, in addition to going to the gym or riding my bike or playing golf, going to these support groups, I have to be on top of it at all times.
Well, you are an exemplary human being. And the work that you're doing is amazing. So how do people listening that want to reach out to you get help?
They can check out my website, mothersaddictionjourney.com. And right on there is my email, my phone number, a general contact form. Please, I would love to help anyone at any time. I'm an open book. I'm very transparent. And just know you're not alone. ever, and we will walk through this journey together. Please don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you so much, Katie, and I wish you all the best in your wonderful, supportive work for our community.
Thank you so much, Lois.
On behalf of Integrity in Action, we want to thank you for listening to Integrity in Action with Lois Shulman. Join us monthly from 7 to 8 p.m. for more information on guests. Your host, Lois Shulman, please visit BodyMindSpiritRadio.com and visit the Integrity in Action show page. Until next time, good night.